This episode of the Commerce Marketer Podcast is brought to you by Bronto Software, the leading email provider to the global internet retailer 1000. For more ideas on how to improve your marketing automation and to take your email to the next level, visit www.bronto.com/resources. Have you ever spent 12 hours staring at a computer screen just to see if a garden bonbon would grow? Amazingly, some people have. Or at least they kept checking back from time to time to see if it was, for no other reason than, well, I don't really know the reason, but this itself is the power of social media. So welcome to the Commerce Marketer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Zakowitz, and we all know that social media and content marketing is rapidly becoming a growing part of a retailer's marketing strategy. In today's episode, we're going to talk social media, content marketing, wins and failures associated with such, and for another reason, whatever else we kind of want to talk about. So joining me today in the conversation is the founder and CEO of VAT19.com, Jamie Salvatore. Welcome to the show, Jamie. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me. This should be fun.
So Jamie, you are the second Jamie S we've had on the show now. So I'm going to hold you to a pretty good comparison during the episode today. I hope that's all right with you.
I will represent for all Jamie's.
Jamie S's at that.
Jamie S's, exactly. Yes, I will try to represent.
So we want to differentiate you between the other Jamie S we've had here. To separate yourself from that Jamie here, why don't you give the audience a little background about yourself and about who VAT19.com is?
Sure. VAT19 is kind of like two things. We are a online retail gift store, and we sell what we call curiously awesome products. And we're also a fairly popular YouTube channel where we try to promote those products, but also have a lot of fun. So we make a variety of different types of video content. Some of it is very commercial in nature. We'll make literally commercials about the products that we sell, but then sometimes we do weird, crazy stuff to just try to promote our channel and brand. And our YouTube channel drives most, if not all, of the traffic to our store. We sell really kind of strange stuff, but it falls into a couple different categories. We sell a lot of candy. We sell a lot of toys. We sell a decent amount of gadgets. And we kind of go for the sort of inner child, if you will. So some of our most popular items are a 5-pound gummy bear, a 3-pound gummy worm. Actually, let me look up and see what's popular this minute. Oh, a slushy maker lets you make a slushy from your favorite drink in less than a minute. Also on the most popular list is a little gadget you can wear on your wrist that lets you shoot out fireballs. So it's a wide range of weird stuff that we promote with crazy videos on YouTube.
So how did you decide that that was a good business to get into? You're sitting around one day and be like, hey, I should just accumulate a bunch of really huge gummy things and fireball wrist shooters and things like that. How'd you get into that business?
Well, there was no business plan, which is
typical.
Yeah. I graduated college and I thought I was going to be like a web designer or something like that. And instead I got sort of involved in our family business, which was video production. And I found that I hated it. I did not like making videos for ad agencies or, you know, sort of the medium-sized businesses in the St. Louis area, which pretty much is like car dealers, grocery stores, and then like big corporations that want really boring marketing training videos. And it's just terrible content. I hated making it. Plus, we weren't really making any money doing it. So I thought, well, if we could control the products that we're making commercials for, then we could make really wild and fun to make commercials, right? Once you've made one car dealer commercial, you've made them all. Once you've made one commercial for a grocery store, you've made them all. So the idea was if we had a store where there wasn't really like a theme to it, then you wouldn't get bored making the videos. So, you know, it was easy to cross off the list, like, you know, oh, let's make a store all about tennis rackets. It's like once you've made, you know, 5 or 10 tennis racket videos, you feel like you'd run out of stuff to say about them and you'd probably get bored. So the idea was, let's find products that need to be demonstrated, but that aren't all the same. And let's see what happens, because we literally could not do worse than how we were currently doing. I mean, when you're losing money, you'll try anything.
So how did you source, you know, kind of out of the box type products there? Was it happenstance that you came across something? It was like, oh, you know what, this is not a bad idea. Or did you know someone that was like, oh, you check out this site over here, or this distributor over here that sells these random things? How did you get to the assortment or the sourcing of these products?
I mean, that took a really long time. So what you see now on our site is, you know, like 10 or 11 years in. You know, we started trying to find products in maybe 2006, 2007. And so for the first couple of years, the site was really weird because there was only, you know, maybe 100 products on there, and there was no theme or connection to it other than just, this is some random stuff. And I mean, we'd try anything that seemed interesting. There wasn't really like one place that you can go to. So we would, you know, you might find a vendor with a catalog and they've got 600, 700 different items that they're wholesaling, and we'll flip through it. Let's say it's a kitchen wholesaler, and they've got, you know, all the stuff that you would kind of expect, but maybe they carry one or two like weird or quirky things. So that's what makes it hard for us, is that, you know, we can't go to one of these distributors and just say, hey, give me your top 400 items and, you know, snap your fingers and now you've got like a little kitchen boutique store or whatever. I mean, we're going to hundreds of different vendors and we're just picking out like one or two weird products that we feel like could benefit from a video demonstration, and then try to make like kind of a weird, quirky video about that product. So it took like a really long time to find products that we thought were interesting and then have the store like feel like it made sense. And maybe it still doesn't.
Yeah, that's really cool. Do you remember what the very first product that you settled on was?
I don't remember like the very first product, because there's like a little bit more, or maybe I do. I don't know, there's a little bit more backstory. So as I was making these terrible videos and commercials for companies here in St. Louis, I thought the most obvious product to start with would be video content. So you got to remember in the early 2000s, DVDs were like so hot. You could basically put any trash onto a DVD and it would sell. And that's kind of what I did for a little bit. So we made like, you know, like the Yule log video where it's just like a fireplace burning. So
yep,
like I went and recorded like friends and family's fireplaces and put that onto a DVD. So that was some of like the first products we were selling on our site, but it became very difficult to keep having to like make the product and sell it as well.
Sure.
So when we very first started, the obvious place to start with was products that like related to these DVDs. So I think one of the very first products I added was a candle that smelled like a fireplace. So the idea was like, buy the DVD fireplace, buy the candle, and now you've got like the whole sensory experience going on.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it probably started with there, and then we kind of like branched out. And I don't want to mention too many of the other products, because then people try to go and find those videos and they're so bad. I don't want anybody to find them.
So that's funny, because you were describing how you're going recording your friends' fireplaces, and I immediately thought of the Seinfeld episode where the coffee table book, and I'm like, you could have famous people's fireplaces on a DVD or whatever. So so I led into this podcast. Yeah. We're talking about content marketing and social media and stuff like that, and we barely touched on any of those things so far. So I'm gonna try to get myself back onto the rails a little bit. You had mentioned before, Jamie, that you guys use YouTube to drive traffic to your site, and you said most of this traffic comes from the website. So let's tie this back in here. How do you guys view social media today? Do you view them as social platforms? Do you view them as sales platforms? Are they marketing vehicles, a combination of these things?
Right. So I have a fairly cynical perspective. So I guess like I don't really consider YouTube to be a social media platform. I sort of reserve Facebook. Sorry, my devices are all making noise. I'm going to turn them all off here.
You've ruined the podcast.
I know. Okay. It was nice meeting you. Goodbye. Okay. So I sort of have a very cynical view of social media. So first, I kind of separate YouTube. I don't really feel like YouTube is a social media platform because it doesn't really have the ability to sort of share stuff with your friends. So I feel like it's just a content consumption platform where you have the ability to call into the radio show and type ridiculous comments. I sort of reserve the moniker of social media for like Facebook, I guess Instagram, you know, and Twitter. And for my business, for other people, those platforms might do great things for their business. But for me, I've had not very much success using Facebook for any sort of business good. And Twitter, same kind of feeling. Instagram maybe is a little better, but those platforms aren't really big drivers for us. YouTube is really what we focus more on. And I know Facebook has been trying to get into video, but we could do a whole hour on the problems we've had with Facebook and the theft of content and how I feel like Facebook isn't, rightfully so, not that interested in helping businesses promote themselves without spending a ton of money with them. So we view YouTube a lot more favorably than those other platforms.
You had mentioned that you guys just haven't had success on some of the social networks, but we talked about Facebook, or you talked about Facebook. Have you not found success there because of the nature of their setup where you've got to kind of pay for play? Or do you just find the audience, for whatever reason, is just not compelled or not interested on what you guys promote on Facebook?
That's a good question. I mean, it could be some of both. The pay-to-play thing is a huge part of it, and I don't really blame Facebook for that. So I've tried paying and just not had a lot of success with it because our retail store is sort of a traditional retail store in that we're reselling other people's products. So our margins are pretty stuck at about 50%. I buy something for, you know, a dollar and I sell it for $2. And if you try to get into direct response selling on Facebook, and I've tried it. I mean, I've blown a lot of money trying Facebook ads, and a couple things would always seem to happen. It might be profitable for the first week your ad is running, but they go stale so fast. Within another week or two, so 3 weeks total, I feel like you're not making any money. You're starting to lose money. So then you try I'll try branding on Facebook. I'll try to just get people to sort of like my Facebook page, right? You don't need to leave Facebook, God forbid, and even check out our website. All you have to do is like our page, and then, right, we'll get all these new fans, and then I can sort of promote to them, quote unquote, for free. You know, so I went and paid for about 50,000 new fans. We have like 200,000 now, and I paid by fake fans, but you know what I mean. I spent money to get 50,000 new fans. And you have no reach, you know? I mean, you put up a organic post or whatever, and it's like, hey, we showed this to like, you know, 1,500, 2,000 people, but we have 200,000 fans. So you pay for this ability to then market to these people that have, you know, so-called sort of subscribe to you or become fans of you, and they just never see your message. So you're wondering, why am I bothering with this? You know, it's going to cost too much money to build it up. And then you're getting like a 1% open rate or whatever on the content that you post, and you're paying 20, 25 cents to get each new, you know, subscriber. So it's just the math doesn't work out for us. I just couldn't justify it. So I stopped it all, and we just went back to what we were regularly doing. And every week we're shedding subscribers now, or shedding fans, because so I keep saying subscribe. I'm so used to YouTube. You're losing fans all the time because, you know, you sort of like bought them, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'm like, this is just a nightmare. The potential, what they sell you on is so great. You know, oh, if you can just get, you know, 10, 12-year-old girls to share your message and then 10 of their friends, blah, 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 you know, it's going to go viral and take over and it's going to be huge. Just has never happened for us.
I think the,
what's happened more. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the overriding point and lesson there is, and this is probably something that a lot of retailers are struggling with, is I talk to people, whether they run social media ad agency or social media agencies or just retailers who are in social, and Facebook is a high driver of sales for them. So I think that's going to be somewhat specific to your business, but other channels like YouTube might be very low on their totem pole, right? So you kind of have the opposite effect. And I think the overall lesson, so you looked at it and said, you know, the numbers don't add up to me. And I think you kind of pulled the plug on it and said, if the numbers don't add up, I'm not doing it. I think a lot of retailers struggle with, hey, everyone keeps telling me Facebook's so great and I'm putting money in there and I'm not seeing the return. And their tendency might be to stick it out because Facebook, everyone keeps telling them Facebook is so great. And I think, you know, to me, the lesson would be, if the numbers don't add up and you're not seeing it, you got to pull the plug and kind of be done with it at that point. So, you know, you guys did it. And I think a lot of retailers do struggle with how to actually do that. And they're scared to break away from something they know could work or is working for other people.
Yeah, you know, you got to keep watering those weeds, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to do it. You can get tricked pretty easily into thinking of believing in crazy concepts like, you know, lifetime value of a customer and a bunch of junk. And for some retailers, Facebook might work really well for them. I would venture to think that retailers that maybe make their own products and you can't really get them elsewhere, or it's a very high margin item, might do better. But all that matters to you in your business is if it works for you. Who cares if it works for somebody else? Like, great for them, but if it doesn't work for you, you got to stop. You got to move on and try something else. And I have tried Facebook, you know, several times. Every once in a while, I'll get another bug, or I'll read some, you know, article and be like, oh, maybe it'll work now. I'll try like related audiences or so. Oh, I'll take all like the email addresses from everyone that's bought from me and I'll upload them to Facebook. And I mean, that was a no difference, you know, equally bad. So I Facebook just isn't right for us.
Yeah, it makes sense. Let's talk about YouTube for a minute, because that is right for you. So you guys have 1,200 plus YouTube videos, so a pretty substantial number. You mentioned, you know, you guys were doing that 11 years ago, which, I mean, at the time, YouTube was relatively in its infancy.
Yeah.
You have a video background, so a lot of those things made sense, and you explained that before, but video is much tougher to produce than getting Photoshop and overlaying some text on an image and just making it look good. You need scripting, you need cameras, you need props, you need editing of those scripts, you need people acting those things, you need the people recording them. So, I mean, the budget is much more expensive to produce. And now you guys, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you have multiple full-time people just doing videos for you. At what point, even knowing you have an added cost associated with it, did you guys look at this and say, you know what, this is worth it. This is where the bang for the buck is going to be. Can you walk us through that pivotal moment and be like, yep, this is it. Let's invest in it.
Well, that was never really a question in my mind. When I started the store, how is it going to be different? And at that time, back in, I don't know, 2005, 2006, most stores had like one picture of the product, usually supplied by the manufacturer, a short description of the product, usually supplied by the manufacturer, and that's it. And I thought, okay, let's do lots of photos and a video. That's why we should pick products that kind of do something. So that's why we don't sell a lot of like decor on our website. I want the product to need a video in order to help explain the product and sell it. So that was requirements. We were going to do this with video, and we got into YouTube because it was free to host our videos there. I mean, that was the reason why I put them there to begin with. And funny little side note, I mean, this is 10, 11, 12 years ago. So back then, other companies trying to sell bandwidth for content would call and say, oh my gosh, are you really sure you want that sort of low-end YouTube branding on your website with your videos. I mean, we can stream your videos for you. It's only going to be $3,000 a month, and we can get rid of all that branding. And and it was just funny that no one would think twice about embedding a YouTube video on their website now. But back then it was, ooh, are you sure you want to have that on your website? YouTube was just a place to put the videos and host them for free. And they played back really well back in 2006, 2007. I mean, the experience was good. To sort of answer your question, I've never really calculated the return on investment of the videos. You know, it's something that I love to do, and I think that it's important and it's worked for our store. It's the heart and soul of the company.
Was there ever a moment when you were getting approached by those different companies, was there ever a moment where you seriously considered, hey, you know what, maybe I shouldn't have this YouTube thing branded over, you know, overlaying the video? Was there ever a moment there, or did you just know, hey, it's free, it works, it plays back, the experience is just fine, I'm good?
Oh, salespeople are good. Yeah, I thought about it, but didn't have the money. So I was just like, well,
easy decision.
Yeah, easier decision. But yeah, I'm sure me and the marketing person here probably spent 2 hours debating it one day, probably. And it was just like, it's not, it's not worth it.
So 11 years ago, do you remember what your first video was?
Yeah, I do. I think it was for this thing called the USB Circus Cannon. It was this little toy that you would put on your desk. I mean, back then, USB gadgets were hot, you know. It was USB fans and USB drink warmers and these little USB toys, and you could sort of put this thing on your desk and put little Nerf darts into it, and kind of you could control it with your keyboard and shoot stuff. That was one of the earliest products. The video is horrific. Please don't go look at it. That was an early one.
Very cool. What was your what's your favorite video?
Oh man, that's tough because we've made so many. I think my favorite is for the world's largest gummy worm. That video's got to be about 7 years old now, but it's, I think, views wise, our second most viewed video. And it's for a product that, since we launched it back then, has been in our top three bestsellers consistently for that entire time frame. It was also a lot of fun to make, and I made some of it with my dad, which was fun. So it's a good one.
Do you know offhand how big that gummy worm is? Is it like a 30-pound thing?
That one? No. It's way more manageable. It's only 3 pounds.
Okay.
It's about 26 inches long, about 4,000 or so calories. It's got two flavors in there. You need some help to get through it, right? I think, you know, it's a good party product.
So you've never eaten one all by yourself?
I've tried, but I've never been successful. 3 pounds of gummy is a lot to put down in one session.
All right, here's the call out, the gummy worm challenge. Go buy an immense gummy worm and see if you can eat.
Yeah. If you can do it in an hour, I don't know.
I was going to say, you can give them a free gummy worm.
Yeah, give you a free one. Yeah, because you'll end up throwing that one up and you'll need another one.
You gave a presentation over the summer at IRC. And you, in that presentation, you mentioned that you guys were humming along, and then in 2016, something happened that really made you guys take pause there. So can you walk the audience through what you experienced in 2016 from a traffic standpoint, and just kind of what you're seeing from the social side, and then what you ultimately learned from it?
Well, in the summer of 2016, it's fairly widely reported that YouTube made an algorithm change, and people that deal with, you know, SEO are familiar with, oh no, you know, an algorithm change that has dramatic impact. And we saw over a very short period of time in the summer of 2016, our number of views drop pretty substantially. I don't remember the exact number, but it was 40 or 50% drop. And the details of sort of what YouTube did aren't really that substantial. But basically, by the nature of having a large audience, which we had at the time, you know, having a large number of subscribers. Maybe we had 3 million at that time. I don't know. You were just sort of quote unquote guaranteed that each new video you put up was going to get huge views. I mean, almost every single video we put up in 2016, we get 1 million views within a week or so. And we just thought that was the norm. And in fact, we sort of thought like, gee, like we have 3 million subscribers, like shouldn't each video be getting like at least 3 million views, you know, for like everyone that's subscribed. So that's no longer the case. Maybe you get 5 or 10% now. It's so much more competitive on YouTube. So we really had to take a look at the types of videos and the type of content we were making and refocus what we were doing. And then YouTube, as it's grown, has gotten so much more competitive. There's so much more content on there that it's very difficult to stand out. Your thumbnail and title are probably the most important part of your video, content aside. So it really caused us to have to like shift our focus. And obviously, when you lose 40 to 50% of the views of the thing that drives all the traffic to your website, your website traffic drops substantially, your orders drop substantially, and your revenue drops substantially. So it's like all of the worst things combined into one. And it was pretty terrible, to be honest with you. And it's taken us a really long time. We still, I don't think we're back to those 2016 levels of views, but we sort of stopped the bleeding and we've got the trend going back up in the right direction. So, you know, all of our marketing is on YouTube. So when something happens to YouTube, it can kill the whole business pretty quickly. So a smart person would diversify, but...
I was just going to say, does that scare you?
Yeah, of course.
Like, do you lie awake at night thinking about that sometimes, being like, man, is tomorrow the day where I'm going to have to go through this again and try to do something?
It's possible. It's also sort of, you know, yeah, oh yeah, you know, you should diversify all that marketing, but there's also, you know, you could be diversifying. So I tried to put a bunch of money into Facebook, and that didn't work really at all.
Sure.
So we went back to YouTube and said, you know, we've got to analyze this, figure out what went wrong or what happened, and then see what we can do to sort of fix it and really focus on making like better content, the type of content we think that, you know, YouTube is now favoring and looking for. So we kind of shifted the type of content we were making. But to answer your question, yeah, it is scary to have a lot of your business relying on one channel, but many businesses are the same. Think of how many businesses, if they lost their number one like client or customer, would be extremely devastated.
Are you comfortable sharing that you said, you mentioned that you're now creating, you shifted the content creation more to what YouTube is looking for. Are you comfortable sharing with what they're looking for?
Sure. Well, no one really knows exactly how the YouTube algorithm works. They don't even know, because it's, you know, machine learning. But they have goals, right? So they want longer watch time. They want people spending a lot of time on YouTube watching stuff. So you can look at simple metrics like, you know, how much of a video is someone watching? And so if people, you know, if you've got a 5-minute long video and people bail after the first 45 seconds, that's probably not something that YouTube is going to want to promote and present to a lot of people. So that's one big factor. You got to make sure the content is good. And when someone does watch it, they stick around and watch a lot of it. And so we were making mostly videos that were like commercials explaining what our, you know, our products and trying to make them fun and entertaining. But what you could find a lot of the time is, you know, people would sort of understand what the product is in the first maybe 20 or 30 seconds of the video, and then maybe not hang around for the whole thing. Or they decide after 20 or 30 seconds, oh, that's not really for me. Like, I'm not that interested in that product, and sort of leave. So we had to make the videos, we had to find a type of content that was more widely appealing, and then kind of work the product in there a little bit less overtly. So we sort of make fewer straightforward product commercials, and now they're a little bit more like a traditional YouTube video where, you know, we do something fun and entertaining, and then there's sort of like a product sort of worked in there. So we're almost like doing brand integration into our own videos, if that makes sense. So I can give you an example.
Yeah, I love examples.
Okay, one of the most popular videos we put out this year was we made the world's largest bath bomb. It was a 2,000-pound bath bomb. It's 4 foot in diameter, weighed 2,000 pounds, obviously. That's just a crazy spectacle. And obviously, we don't sell 2,000-pound bath bombs. The idea is to just like get attention, and then, you know, we sell. So we made that giant bath bomb a black bath bomb, in that it turns the water black. And that's mimicking a normal size bath bomb that we sell that does the same thing. So the idea was we sort of briefly mention this actual bath bomb that we sell, but really the video is about this 2,000-pound bath bomb that we made. And so that's sort of the shift in thinking, is that there's a product in here, it's related in here, but it's not like a commercial for that product.
So that's a great example. The way you guys are making videos now compared to what you did before, right? So these subtle product placements, for lack of a better term, did that make the video production, the script writing, the process that you guys do in-house, did that make it harder for you? Did it make it easier for you? And in the same vein, does the new process seem to stifle creativity a little bit more, or has it actually helped the creativity because you have to think a little more outside the box than you did before?
Well, you know, we were kind of doing this stuff a couple years ago. We just weren't doing it very often.
Okay.
And basically we changed the sort of mix and just decided, hey, wait, these concept videos is how we refer to them, because they're not really a product video. It has a larger concept, and then there's some product mixed in. We were doing those maybe once a month before. Now we're trying to do a couple of those each week because they just perform so much better on YouTube. But the difficulties that they present are that sometimes those videos are a lot more difficult to produce. Making a 2,000-pound bath bomb is a very big and expensive endeavor versus making like a simple sort of commercial, you know, showing off this regular size bath bomb that turns your bathtub black, right? So yes, they're a bit more difficult to produce. So we've had to figure out ways to I can give you another example of something that's still a concept video, but didn't require spending, you know, $3,000 on materials just to make a 2,000-pound bath bomb. We have this popular series of videos called Real Versus Gummy, where we just sit at a table, and it started almost a whole genre of videos on YouTube. You go into YouTube and search for Real Versus Gummy, there's so many videos, and we made the very first one. You basically sit at a table and you spin a wheel, and it'll, you know, it has like worm, bear, snake, frog, all the different types of gummy that exist. And when you land on one, you get both the real thing and the gummy thing. And you're there with a friend, and one of you's got to eat a real worm, and the other one has to eat the gummy worm.
Very nice.
Yeah. So yes, it's got our products in there, but it's not like a commercial about those products. But it's a lot easier to produce than, say, the 2,000-pound bath bomb. So we had to get creative and clever and trying to figure out ways that we can make videos that aren't such in-your-face commercials, but also don't cost a fortune to make.
So how easy was it to find someone that would say, yeah, I want to be in this video, and yes, I'm willing to eat XYZ in real life? Was that hard? And like, I'm assuming you don't put that language in like your employment contract. Be like, hey, you might have to eat a worm at some point.
Well, one of the guys that worked here came up with that idea. So that's sort of like an unwritten rule. I mean, if you come up with the idea, you have to participate. So that's one guy down.
That's fair.
I'm willing to do most things. And actually, in that first video, it's like, I think 6 or 8 different people here. I mean, I think they were intrigued, like, what does snake meat taste like? And I'd like to eat a little bit of gator meat. And I mean, the worms was pretty gross, but there's some adventurous folks here that, you know, we sell a gummy brain and they were willing to eat some cow brain and they were willing to eat some cow tongue and all that. So
were they cooked or raw?
Cooked.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely. I'd be more down to do the cooked stuff.
Yeah. The worms were raw. Those were just, you know, freshly dug up from the ground outside.
Yeah. Go pluck them outside, you know?
Yeah. We just harvested those right real quick outside. It's fun though. You know, I think we've made 3 of those videos now and they've been very, very popular.
And I do have a follow-up question on the 2,000-pound bath bomb as well. So
yeah,
you guys are sitting around that room, whatever, meeting session, brainstorming sessions, whatever you're doing. And someone comes up. Who comes up with the idea of a large bath bomb?
That was actually my idea.
Okay. So I'm curious from the point of, okay, everyone says, yeah, that's kind of cool. Let's do that. What did the poundage start at? Like, was it, hey, we should do a 50-pound? Like, how did you get to 2,000? Be like, all right, 2,000 is enough. But 1,500 is not enough. Like, how'd you get to that number?
Okay. So on that one, it was going to be even bigger. we brought it down because, you know, yeah, I wanted it to be gigantic because I'm thinking about, you know, the thumbnail and I'm thinking you got a grown adult standing next to this thing that gives you the scale and you're just like, you know, you read the title and you're like bath bomb and you're just like, what, I have to click on, like, what is this? So I wanted it to be originally 6 feet in diameter. And we started doing some math and we were just like, okay, that's just too big. So we kept bringing it down till we got to like something that was somewhat affordable. Like I was trying to get the costs under, like, of the raw materials, I was trying to get the cost under like $2,000. So that's how that happened.
Very cool. Before I kind of shift focus here, you had mentioned 2 things before and you just followed up with one of them a second ago. You mentioned that title and thumbnail might be the 2 most important things in the video. What makes a good title on YouTube?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't know.
You got a guy in charge of titles there who worries about that?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. Like we have a Slack group called Titles. And so me, our head of the video team, and our 3 writers are all in that show. So that's 5 people. So every week, you know, for the new videos that are coming out, we start a new thread and we just start throwing out ideas and talking about it. I mean, we'll spend like a half hour or more trying to figure out what explains what you're going to see, but is intriguing, doesn't give everything away, right? So what you don't want is a title and thumbnail that make it so that you don't have to watch the video where you feel like, oh, okay, I get it. I kind of know what this is going to be. I don't need to bother watching it. You don't want that, but you don't want it to be so vague that, you know, you're not going to click on it. You obviously want to avoid clickbait. That's not good because you don't want a bunch of people clicking on your video and then leaving really early, like I talked about. You got to balance all of those things. And look, we get this wrong all the time. So like, we're no experts. I mean, we'll look at the analytics a couple days after a video goes up, and if the click-through rate isn't where we want it to be, we'll change it. You know, we'll try a different title. As far as thumbnails are concerned, we spend a lot of time on the thumbnails. We actually, you know, take a photograph specifically to be each thumbnail. We spend a lot of time on it. Sometimes we'll make multiple versions and we'll put it out there to a group of people and see what they think about it, either on our community tab on YouTube, or there's a couple times where I've just like paid to put it out there on Amazon Mechanical Turk and just say, which of these images you prefer, A or B, and see if there's a preference. We try to make it so that the thumbnail communicates in about 2 seconds when viewed really small, can communicate something, a simple message that, you know, makes you want to click on it. Oftentimes we'll try to include some text on that thumbnail because we know people don't always read your title. Yeah, we obsess a lot over that because it's the cover of your book. And if you look at your stats in YouTube, they'll show you what that click-through rate is, and it correlates to views almost perfectly. So if your title and thumbnail are driving low click-throughs, you're going to get low views. And the opposite is true as well. So, you know, I talked about, you got to make sure people actually like watch your video and make it through. The correlation to retention, in my experience, isn't nearly as strong as the correlation to click-through. So your title and thumbnail are almost, and this is a little bit of a hot take, but it's almost more important than the content of the video itself.
That's awesome. And we got a hot take alert, which is even cooler.
Yeah, gotta have those.
Kind of wrap up the conversation here. Jamie, if you're moving into just another company, Retailer X today, and you want to start up a video, you know, department there.
Don't.
Yeah, don't. How would retailers look at this? Because video is obviously, it's a hot topic right now. People are understanding that viewers are consuming videos, or consumers are consuming videos at a much higher clip now. YouTube, from a traffic standpoint, is growing. So people are trying to get these things, get different videos created. How should a retailer realistically look at whether they should either dabble in this, hire someone, promote an intern to do this? Are they looking at volume of sales they do? Are they looking at the variety of products? Because you had mentioned that was important for you guys. Is it the age of their target demo or something else to determine, yeah, this will probably work for you, this might not work for you, or you should probably test into this a little bit. Like, what criteria are you looking at?
Okay. Thank you for inviting me to this job interview. I'm thinking, what would I say? Okay, so first of all, you got to decide who's the audience for these videos and where are they watching these videos. My inclination would be to be most cost effective that I would not be making these videos to sort of gain new customers. I would be making these videos to try to close a sale on my website. So I use my videos to try to like find new customers and create fans, and eventually they come to my website and buy something. But I've been building up an audience on YouTube for 11 years, and I've spent, you know, probably millions and millions of dollars trying to do that, because that's my business model, and the products I sell happen to appeal to your typical majority YouTube customer. But if you're a retailer of, I don't know, like home security cameras, you should not be spending a bunch of money trying to sort of build up a YouTube channel. You should be making videos to have on your website that close the sales. So you should, you know, if you're going to invest in that, hire some people at your, you know, for your company to develop and make those videos. Or if you only need a couple videos and you don't need ongoing, then hire a company to, you know, or an ad agency if you've got a lot of money to burn and you're somewhat of a masochist. You can hire an ad agency to develop this content for you and put it up on your website. And if you want to use YouTube to generate traffic, there are a lot of, in the long run, cheaper ways to do it than trying to sort of build your own channel. That's not the only thing you could do on YouTube. You could run ads on YouTube. You could hire YouTubers to talk about your product and promote it. So just use it as an ad platform, like you would use, you know, Facebook or, you know, AdWords. So that would be my general approach.
Great advice. I appreciate the thoughtful answer there.
Did I get the job? Like, is there a 401k?
If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be?
I'll take it. I'll take the job.
You got a couple minutes to stick around for some fun questions?
Sure. Yeah.
I say they're fun. They're probably not fun whatsoever, but
no, I like it.
You know, that's the thing we do here.
Yeah.
All right. So what's your favorite Vet 19 product?
Oh man, there's so many. So many. Okay. I'll give you two. My favorite to eat is probably our gummy watermelon slice, because it just tastes so good and it looks so cool. I think my favorite product to kind of like fun sort of thing to use is called the Key Picks. It's kind of a strange name, but it's like an instant photo printer. No batteries, no nothing. Lets you take pictures from your phone. So you kind of, it like takes a picture of your phone screen and makes like a Polaroid of it.
Okay.
It's the best way to explain it. the Keebics. It's so cool. It's like low tech and simple, but just really cool that you can sort of print all these Polaroids from your phone. Those are two of my favorite right now.
That is pretty cool. And I'm assuming people with kids might get just as much enjoyment out of that because you have so many people take pictures on their phones and never really do anything with them nowadays.
Yeah, like kids love that Instax film, but you got to go get like another camera, you know, and load that in there. And then you take the picture, and if it wasn't really a good one, you've wasted that photo. And, you know, they're not cheap, each one of those instant film, I don't even know what you call them, prints, you know, but this way you can get the picture just the way you want it on your phone, and then put your phone on top of this thing, you hit a button, and boom, out comes your instant print, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's been very popular for us, and I saw it at a show back in the very beginning of this year, like January. And it was at the end of a show, and I was feeling depressed because I'm like, there's nothing good here. This was a total waste. And I see this thing, and I actually told the guy, you just saved the whole show for me. This is the coolest thing I've seen this entire time. And it's been a great seller for us.
Very cool. Hey, Jimmy, is a hot dog a sandwich?
Oh, snap. Okay. Let's see. No. I think it's closer to a wrap than it is a sandwich, because a sandwich has two pieces of bread and the hot dog has one piece of bread. I think it's more in the wrap family than the sandwich family.
Oh man, that's interesting.
Did I get that right? Is that correct?
I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer here, but this is a raging debate here. I've never had the wrap variable come in.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking because, you know, it's kind of, I mean, how do people push the sandwich argument? What do they say?
Well, it's meat between two pieces of bread.
But it's not two pieces of bread. The bun is one piece.
Well, it depends on probably the quality of the bread. But let me throw this. You go to your favorite sub or hoagie restaurant, right? And they cut that bread. They don't cut it generally in half. They cut it almost like a hot dog sandwich and then put whatever you want in there. So would that be a wrap or would that be a sandwich?
Oh, see, now I see where you're going. Well, I would pose the following. If you get a hot dog and the bun is split, you feel like a mistake has happened here.
That's true. That's true.
Now, if you go to Subway and you know, they sort of, you know, cut that, you know, thing and the two pieces were to split apart, you wouldn't be like, oh, this is a mistake and no longer eatable, right?
Because it's a valid point.
Yeah, because like the hot dog, you know, it's like, you know, it's the canoe, you know, that bun is the canoe, and it's holding all those, you know, toppings in. And if the bun splits, those toppings are gone. But if my bread splits on a sandwich, my toppings are still there intact. So I feel like that's... Right,
let me diversify here a little bit. Okay. Then if I take the hot dog, the actual meat out of the hot dog bun, okay, and it's all in one piece still, and okay, I replace it with turkey meat, does that change the conversation? Would that be a wrap or in the wrap family?
I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's like, it's a branch off that family. You know, I think they have like a common ancestor. I'm not sure what the common ancestor to the wrap would be.
Pizza? Like, is pizza an open face sandwich?
maybe the calzone. I mean, it's in that like calzone wrap sort of that. I mean, I really feel like also the way it's physically arranged and you look at it. I gotta think about this some more. It's just not a sandwich. Yeah, just a hot dog just isn't a sandwich, because you would call it a hot dog sandwich then, and no one does. It's its own thing.
All right, let me throw a curveball at you. You guys sell a 33-pound gummy hot dog on vet19.com. Is that a wrap in the wrap family, or is that just candy?
Well, okay. So it's probably just candy, only because the way in which it's manufactured, it's kind of all one piece. You can't pull the dog out of the bun. So it probably falls into the candy category. But I feel like
the whole, like, I'm just saying it's like a hot dog is more like a wrap than it is a sandwich. It's not really a wrap. I just don't feel like a hot dog is a sandwich. Because then why does it have its own name? And why wouldn't you just call it like a mixed meat sandwich then? You know?
Yeah, but see, here's the other argument with that, right? People will say the same thing about hamburger. Hamburger has its own name to it. I don't know, I guess you might not consider a hamburger a sandwich, right? But that generally has two individual pieces of bread for the most part. But it's really just a heap of meat, right? It's a taco and bread instead of a shell. I don't know.
What do most people think?
This is why it's a raging debate.
It is a good debate. But I feel like other than like pulled pork, which they do call a sandwich, usually comes delivered on a hamburger style bun. So you're opening my eyes up to some other possibilities here. Is it your contention then that all of these things are under like the parent of sandwich, and that you've got sort of these like subspecies of sandwiches, like a hot dog is a subspecies of sandwich and a hamburger is a subspecies of sandwich? And
I think so. I waffle on this one a little bit, right? But I think hot dog might be like the stepchild here, where it's like, oh, the family split up and we're got this other person come in the family. We like him and everything, but he's not really my family. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of like classification that they do in the animal kingdom. scientists debate on this stuff all the time. And I think usually they got to like dive into the DNA in order to figure out like who's related to whom and who's a parent of whom and who's related. I don't know if that like is like a new area of research maybe you want to consider for your sandwiches. And
I might have found myself a new career.
I don't know, but I might be coming around to your point of view that they're all subspecies of sub classifications of sandwich. I don't know.
Well, maybe one of these days, if you guys ever do this as a video to sell a 33-pound gummy hot dog or something, maybe I could cameo in that video.
Yeah, it's the hot dog sandwich, right? It's the hot dog sandwich video. Yeah,
that's right. Next time I get to St. Louis, we'll grab a beer and we'll discuss this. Jamie, you have any guilty pleasures? TV show, music, anything like that?
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess guilty pleasure means like you know it's bad.
Yeah.
Not so much the TV shows, but like I love pure pop music. Love it. I know it's not good. I know the music isn't, I know it's not good music and I'm too old for it. I know that. And I should be better, right? I should be like listening to like important music or something, like good music. But you give me some T Swift, you give me some Katy Perry, even like the newer pop kids that are so good. I'll take that all day.
Is Party in the USA a good song?
No.
Okay. How about Bop?
No.
Baby Shark?
None of them are good. I don't know. How do you define good? Like on iTunes, right? The pure pop radio. Like that's the go-to.
Okay.
Right? If I'm sitting working, I hate to admit it, but that's the go-to. And if like Sugar by Maroon 5 comes on, I'm like, turn that up. I know it's not like a great song or like, you know, a lot of Katy Perry, for instance, or even like Taylor Swift, 1989, that whole album. It's like start to finish, just maybe it's because I sell like giant candy mostly for a living that like I indulge on things that are bad for you. But yeah, that's like the guilty pleasure. It's like sort of bad pop music.
So if you're going karaoke, your go-to pop song, what song are you choosing?
Oh, I can't. I can't do karaoke. No, I can't.
Oh, but I can't. I'm making you.
No, yeah, I can't.
You're not going to get the job unless you do karaoke, Jamie.
I'd have to mumble over this song. Oh, I don't know the lyrics. I will not sing in public or in like a video. For instance, we have a video series and there's like a challenge in each one. And if I lose, our producer here comes up with it. Once she was like, okay, Jamie, you got to sing the national anthem. And I just flat out refused. And he's like, you have to do it. I mean, it's part of the challenge. And I was like, I won't do it. You can't force me to do it. I own the company. I'm leaving.
I was going to say, she knows you own the company, right?
Yeah. But I just, it's sort of like an honor thing, right? You should do the challenge. I couldn't do it. I tried. I opened my mouth, but nothing came out. It's, you know, some people just like can't do public speaking, right? They'll just like freeze up, or they'd rather die than speak in public. I would rather die than sing in public.
Man, that's extreme.
It is extreme, isn't it?
But that's fair.
Isn't it? But don't you have, I'm sure you've got something you're like, I won't do that. Or something you won't eat, or it's got to be something that you just won't do.
I'll do most things, although I don't like dancing. I'll be honest with you. It's tough to get me to dance. Eating, there's probably things that I would probably look at and be like, yeah, I don't really want to eat that. I mean, I'm sure there's something I won't do.
But that would like cause intense anxiety about it.
Oh, I'll tell you what, scuba diving would freak me the hell out.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
It's something about...
Why?
Like, I went snorkeling, so I went to Key West with my wife last year, and we went snorkeling, and I had never been snorkeling before, so we went out to one of the coral reefs out there, and we went snorkeling. It was my first time, my wife had been before, and I did it, and I had fun, but the first, I don't know, 3 minutes I was out there, like, I was out of my element. I just had this like sense of fear come over me. And I was like, this is just not right.
Really?
And there's a boat, you know, there's a big boat right next to me and everything. It was somewhat irrational, but
yeah, you're like close to safe.
I could think of scuba diving and just going underwater in this open, vast area, not knowing how far away I'm swimming away from whatever I might be swimming by, right? Like the boat or whatever. I think I would just have a heart attack.
Really? It's not that you think a great white shark is going to come snack on you.
No.
It's just like sort of...
Am I getting stuck down here?
Am I going to get lost or kind of stuck down there?
Yeah.
Wow. Like, that's possible. Like, there are, and this is not going to help, but there are people that have gone on scuba diving, like, trips, outings, and they'll leave someone behind. You know, and drive back, and then they come up to the surface and the boat's gone and they've left them.
They made a movie about that once, didn't they?
Yeah, but it actually really does happen to people. So I feel like your fear there is somewhat justified. But like my fear with like singing is public is that if I do it, it will immediately lead to the end of my life. Like it will kill me to do this. And therefore, why would anyone do it? It'd be like akin to just jumping off a building. Like this is suicide to do this. And it's obviously irrational fear. But yours is a little bit more grounded in reality.
Yeah, but I got like a lot of things, right? Laws of averages. It's like cruise ships. People fall off cruise ships all the time. I say all the time, but it's in reality, it's two people a year.
It happens enough. So I remember reading the story not that long ago, and they found the person. Like a couple of weeks ago, somebody fell off, and like a nearby Navy or something rescued the person.
That's a lucky person right there.
That's a lucky person, I know. But I mean, yeah, it happens enough.
Hey, you ever think to yourself, man, what if I have like a voice like Barry Manilow? Like you just have a perfect voice, but you refuse to sing.
That would be a crime, wouldn't it? You got to share that gift, don't you?
So do you have a good voice? You just don't like singing?
Oh, no. That is not.
Because I'm sure if you listen to pop music, I'm sure you're singing. Like you're in the car, you're probably singing to yourself, right?
Oh, sometimes. Oh, and I know it's not on pitch or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I can't sing.
All right. So you don't have like this hidden talent you're just keeping from the world.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Okay. If I could, that 19 would be a very different YouTube channel. It would just be all covers, probably. Terrible covers of pop songs by me. You know, I can't do it. And it's just one of these things that you either can or can't do, right? So I just feel like a little bit like, why me? You know?
This has been a really engaging and interesting kind of fun part of it. I'm enjoying this a lot. I wish the whole podcast could be this, to be honest with you.
We could. And then at the very end, I could be like, yeah, no, YouTube's okay, but it's kind of expensive to get into. And that's it. And avoid Facebook. You know, that's pretty much the summary here.
Use direct mail.
You know, it's funny, though. I see a lot more retailers going back to like older stuff. You know, I see a lot of them trying catalogs, and some are even, you know, pop-up shops or like actually at least the direct-to-consumer manufacturer retailers opening up stores and stuff.
So I was having this conversation with someone a couple months ago, and we were talking about just this, the rise of direct mail that we're both getting at our houses. And I mentioned to him, I said, you know what? I used to hate direct mail. I actually respond to it a lot. At least I'm open a lot more to it now than I was a couple of years ago. And I don't know if that's because I'm working in marketing and doing this and using a critical eye on this day to day, or it just appeals to me because it was out of the, it was out of my line of vision for so long that I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. It's a nice picture. I don't know what it is, but I'm getting a lot more of it.
Like a novelty.
I'm much more open to it than I used
to. Like I can flip this thing over. I don't have to like swipe it. I can just I can sort of look at both sides so quickly. Yeah, it's very interesting. I read articles recently, you know, about a lot of these. I don't know. They're not really subscription companies. They're just sort of these companies that focus on like one consumer product that they want to ship to you directly. You know, the Dollar Shave Clubs of the world. Or whatever, and how so many of them have, this is sort of a tangent, but have found that their costs in skipping going through the traditional retailers who have an audience and saying, well, we're going to go build our own audience and cut that middleman out, and the prices are going to be way lower, have found it so difficult to get attention, and they end up having to spend a fortune on marketing and advertising, and some of them have gone so far as to literally open up stores, like physical stores, to come see their product, and then their price creeps way up because, you know, what they thought was sort of a overhead free business is no longer the case, and find it very difficult to compete. And I guess what I'm saying is there's just no way, it seems, to get around the high costs of marketing and advertising and the general appeal of social media, that you can rapidly multiply your efforts sort of for free with viral effects, doesn't necessarily pan out that often. And there's no way to do it other than spending a ton of money to market and promote your brand.
You know, it's funny because you mentioned viral a minute ago, and this is one thing I neglected to ask you about, but the way I look at, you know, if you look at videos and talk about viral videos, I mean, you might get that exposure across Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and things like that there, but, you know, you get some write-ups and some earned media out of it, but, you know, viral things don't last forever. That's why they're called viral. They kind of hit and then they go away. So even if, you know, XYZ retailer, you know, if they sell pillows for a buck or something, they get a viral video or viral commercial going out there, that at some point in the next, you know, week to two, that thing's gone. And then it's like everything else, out of sight, out of mind. So even if you've gotten that exposure, they've got to keep coming up with something to keep you sucked in or to keep you tuned in. And most people that are companies that do that, they don't have that follow-up there. They're just kind of like, oh, we got our name out there, and you kind of hope for it. So, you know, everyone else is selling it, then you got to start spending your ad on that one. So I don't know if you have a different perspective of viral videos. I mean, they could be helpful, but they're not a means to an end, you know?
I totally agree with you. What we find with YouTube, which is frustrating, is that what you convince yourself of is, okay, well, if you get these popular videos, you'll get people to subscribe to your channel, right? Or like you on Facebook, and then you can continue to, you know, market to them for free. But the reality is that that's not true. You can only market to a very small subset of them for free, you know, a couple percent maybe. Otherwise, you got to keep paying either Facebook to get in front of them, or like on YouTube for us, for instance. I mean, we have, you know, 5.5 million subscribers. Well, pretty good video for us might get in the first week 500,000 views. So that's like 10% of our audience sees it. And so you've got to really be pushing and trying to come up with crazy, creative, clever stuff to sort of push it. I mean, we consider a successful video getting like a really successful video getting like 1 million views, which would be like, you know, 1/5 of our sort of supposed subscribed audience. So how do you, you know, get to the rest of them? I mean, you'd have to, you know, pay or whatever. And it's not like the videos we're making are free to begin with anyway. So the quote unquote promise of social media seems to me to be just another place you can spend your marketing dollars. And there's really nothing that special about it other than the possibility, as rare as it may be, of larger exposure than what you paid for. But it's definitely not a common occurrence.
That's fair. And I appreciate you saying that it's not that special at the end of the podcast, so that we didn't tune anyone away. So, JB, I have enjoyed the conversation immensely. I want to be respectful of your time here. Just two questions, and then we can wrap up here. Normally, I'll set a 15-second timer and ask you to name as many fish as you can in 15 seconds. I feel like you may have prepared for that one a little bit. So I'm going to set a timer, 15 seconds. I want you to name as many VAT 19 products as you can in 15 seconds. You ready?
Yes.
Go.
Miracle Berry, Nano Dots, World's Largest Gummy Bear, World's Largest Gummy Worm, the Card Sharp. Oh, you're killing me. How am I not doing better than this? Oh, I'm freezing up. They're my own products. They're my own products. I'm just all I'm thinking of. Oh, Extreme Pop Rocks. I got Warhead Candy Canes. I've got the Pyro Mini Shooter. Oh, I talked about that earlier. That's almost not fair. Human Slingshot. The Da Vinci Catapult. Oh, Liquid Glass Putty. Glow in the Dark Putty.
Your time ended like 30 seconds ago.
Are you serious? How many did I get? Like five? That was terrible.
You got five. Yeah.
Five? I feel like.
But you got about five after hours, which is good. It's like extra credit.
I didn't cheat because I have my website open in a tab and I switched away from it. And I could have.
Well, I appreciate that.
I could have cheated like crazy.
That's not bad. You weren't expecting it. You've got thousands of products, so the pickings were slim.
Yep.
Jamie, any questions for me today, man?
Well, you mentioned folks that are crushing it on Facebook. What kind of companies are these generally? Because I can speculate, but you would know. Are they high margin product sellers, expensive products? Are they manufacture these things themselves? Who's having success on Facebook and why?
It depends on who I'm talking to, right? If I'm talking to the retailer, I'm talking to the social media agency because they deal with obviously different verticals. We'll just go from the retailer standpoint. Typically, it's not always the case, but typically it's going to be the retailers that they kind of produce their own stuff. So it's, I want to be cautious about giving away names, but a widget that they have probably, my guess would be 60, 65% margins on those things, maybe a little bit more, but around that. So it's above the 15% mark. So there's typically, not always the case, but typically there is some sort of, they have the ability to, because they have the higher margins, to discount more. So they run the sales on there. So it's not just, hey, check this out, or coming over, there's a discount in there, but they've got the ability to pay for the ad and then give away some margins on top of that and kind of absorb that hit a little bit. But I mean, you see some in fashion as well, but I would say even the fashion ones, they have the ability to discount a little bit more. So that's part of the driving force behind the ad itself. I've seen a little bit from an uptick on kind of using it in a different way as well. So as opposed to saying, hey, I've got an email list of 300,000 people and I'm going to do a lookalike audience for these buyers or whatever that are active subscribers to my email list. Some of the retailers who have found success with this would actually take people who are lapsed customers, right? They haven't purchased in 9 months or whatever, or maybe they unsubscribed and they target those people versus your active and engaged people because the rationale is, well, they're active and engaged with my emails, so I'm in front of them, they're seeing me, they're probably just not ready to buy, and me advertising on Facebook doesn't really help me with that. But they'll take people who are maybe in their quote-unquote lapsed or churned area, and I'll try to retarget them as, I don't want to say last-ditch effort, but it's an extra effort to try to get them, hey, can I get them back? Otherwise, I'm just going to cut them loose and never talk to them again. So, I mean, there's different strategies with it as well, whether you want to target the active or the unengaged or the lapsed people out there. But to answer the general question, because I give long-winded answers, typically it's the ones that I would anticipate having a little higher margins. There's usually some sort of discount driven behind the promotion where they're able to draw the traffic in from that standpoint. So there's a little bit of wiggle room with giving away a little more margin there.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah. I could just never, get that much success with the direct sales on Facebook, and
Yeah, I think I mentioned it, but the one thing we noticed, I noticed so often, was just the decline in success of the ad. You know, they seem to kind of do well right off the bat, and then within a couple of weeks, they would get, you know, really stale and really ineffective. And it was like, man, this is just nonstop, you know. And I'd rather go make some videos, so I'm done. You know, it's like, I can't, you know, you try, you know, a lot of things, and then you're just like, man, you know, this $60 widget, you know, cost me $30 and it's costing me $28 to get a sale. Like, this isn't worth it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that's for business or life. Like, I always tell people, if you know who you are and you know what you got going into it, your expectations should kind of be set there. So, you know, if you guys know your video is the bread and butter on it and Facebook's not working for you, like, it takes courage. I think it takes courage to pull the plug on something that seemingly everyone is on, whose stock's going, although they're down now, but
tell me about it.
But if you're not, I know, right? But if you're not, you know, if you're not having success there, you know, why be there? And I tell that people in life too. Like, if you go into a marriage, I always joke around, but I'm like, hey, she knew what she was getting when she married me, right? It was, you know, as long as you have those expectations going in, you can deal with all the other stuff and me being a jerk all the time and things like that. So
you sound really terrible.
I know, right? My wife never laughs.
Yeah. Oh man. We've love YouTube and, you know, love that challenge, and we don't really have many of our own products. And I would say that the last couple of years for us have been very challenging because of the changes on YouTube, but also, you know, I feel like Amazon's effect has, I don't know, for whatever reason, the last couple of years, I feel like they hit like a serious sort of tipping point as far as just where people start looking for products. You know, I think whereas a couple of years ago, you might start at Google and be like, oh, I'm going to search for whatever at Google. You go to Amazon now, you know? And I think that tipping point has made it difficult for a lot of retailers. I could be wrong, but we feel it a lot. I mean, what people call us and tell us, like, oh man, like, just bought your gummy bear off of Amazon, like, love it. And we're like, yeah, that's not me, you know? You bought it from someone else, you know. We don't sell anything on Amazon, and they don't, you know, sort of realize it. Or like, you go and search for VAT 19 on Amazon, and like half our product category, half our products, our most popular products, like, show up there, which is a really strange thing because they're not our products. So we found that, like, I don't know if other, that might not be the topic of your sort of podcast at all, but it's just sort of like the Amazon effect over the last couple years has definitely increased for us, we feel.
So do you not sell on Amazon because of the margins? You mentioned you guys are roughly, you know, I'm sure they give and take, but roughly 50% margin, and then having that eaten away more by Amazon. Is that the reason that you're not on Amazon?
No, most of our vendors disallow it, and they say that they want to be the only person, or they've like knighted one company with the ability to sell their stuff on Amazon. You know, they say they, oh, we love all of our retailers, but I mean, they love Amazon a lot. And they love all of us promoting their products and creating awareness for it. And then people go to Amazon to actually complete the purchase. And we found that a lot for us in the last couple of years is we create a lot of interest for a product, and then people just go and buy it on Amazon. I don't blame them, but it's frustrating.
Have you guys ever looked into creating your own products, like having your own line?
A little bit. We've created a couple. Like, we have, and how I didn't mention this on your 15-second thing, but we sell this thing called the world's hottest chocolate bar. We sell a lot of spicy stuff. It's the spiciest thing you can put into your mouth. The chocolate bar is only 1 inch by 1.25 inches, and it's divided into 12 squares. So you can imagine how small each square is. And the challenge is, can you eat all 12 squares in 12 minutes? And most people can't get through more than 1 or 2 squares. And that's a product we made ourselves, and we made a whole bunch of challenge videos on YouTube, and we sell a lot of those. So yes. So to answer your question, yes, but I mean, I don't want to make excuses and have a pity party, but product development's pretty difficult, especially when you don't really know anything about it. Like, I don't know much about it. I know about making videos. And just, I've seen so many of the vendors whose products we sell earn a level of popularity and get knocked off immediately. And then the knockoffs are selling on Amazon within months of their product coming out and becoming moderately popular. There's all these knockoffs at half the price they're selling it. And it's just, here I go ranting about Amazon, but it's listed under the same name and everything. So these people are trading off of someone's trademark name, and it's selling on Amazon. You know, I just think that a lot of fraud is happening on a lot of intellectual sort of property fraud is occurring on Amazon's marketplace, not maybe by them, but on the platform that they've created that allows third parties to sell there. I think a lot of vendors' products are getting knocked off.
And that's been a challenge for them for a couple of years now, but it's really come to the forefront the past year plus, where large name brand retailers are pushing back and forcing them to crack down. Unfortunately, I think it's always going to be this revolving door. They shut some down, and then, you know, someone else just, it's whack-a-mole, right? Someone comes down, someone else goes up, and you're always there. That's got to be a challenge for you guys. Do you guys feel pressured into, hey, we got to jump on XYZ product in the next month before it gets knocked off and sell as much as we can in the next month? Or do you take the long play forward and say, hey, let's do the best we can in the short term, but let's just go the long play here and see what, you know, what can stick around until it gets knocked off?
By the nature of how we promote our products, making these videos, I can't move super, super rapidly. And we hope that we can be selling a product for a very long period of time. And so what you kind of hope is that, I mean, this is a weird thing to hope for, but that a product doesn't get like too popular.
Yeah.
or if it does, it peaks and then kind of comes back down to a level at which it's of no interest to the knockoff folks. They can't quite sell enough of them to make it worthwhile, but there's still enough interest that people will try to come and buy it from us. So I know that sounds like kind of counterintuitive. Why wouldn't you want massive hits? But I've just seen it happen enough times that it's like, we can't really try to be like first, because it takes too long to make the video, and it's so easy for any other retailer or Amazon seller or basement Amazon seller to just steal a picture off the internet or take a picture of themselves real quick and have a product up, you know? So we try to take a longer, you know, a longer approach, but we also try to come up with other ways to find ways to sell products in sort of a different configuration that, you know, can't be replicated on Amazon, which is why we sell a lot of like food and candy that folks don't want to sell on Amazon. Either the price is too low, or it requires special, you know, packaging, like it's going to melt, you know? So we sell a lot of stuff where you've got to package it up and like melt protection, and Amazon's not going to do that.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Well, it's got to be challenging, but I wish you guys the best of luck on that front.
Thanks.
That's got to be a revolving door that's just probably hitting you anytime, every day.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Probably not wrapping up anytime soon.
Yeah, and the pricing wars, you know, are always a challenge. But we try to focus on what we think makes us special, which is the videos, basically. So we just try to remember that you can't really knock off Event 19 video.
There you go. That could be a challenge in itself.
No, because I don't want to see some 12-year-old that can do it way better than we can.
If someone's knocking those off, they got a lot of time on their hands, man.
That's true. That's true.
Good questions. Any other questions for me, Jamie?
No, I think that might be it.
This has been a really good conversation. We kind of had two different conversations, which is cool. I enjoyed the hell out of it. We'll have info in the episode description on how to contact you, your website, things like that. If someone wants to reach out to either you or the company, what's the best way for them to find you guys?
Oh, just the contact form on our website is the best way. And we read it, you know, it's not going into a black hole. We'll read it. And if somebody really wants to get in touch with me, if you use the contact form and you say, hey, will you send this to Jamie, our customer service folks will send it to me.
Very cool. So that's vat19.com. So VAT19.com. And again, it'll be in the episode description. So feel free to jump down there and check them out. Jamie, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It was fun. Thank you for letting me ramble.
Yeah, that was good. So thanks everyone else for listening, including the listener of the week, Nicole from Newton, Massachusetts. If you'd like to be a listener of the week, let me know you're tuned in. And if you're interested in telling your e-commerce story, I'd love to hear from you as well. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Until next time, have a great day and be kind to one another.